Hi, everybody. It's Mary Lou Tyler. This week's guest is Sean Campbell. He's the CEO of a B2B market research firm that's focused on the tech industry, but he has got some great knowledge that I think we can all benefit from, coming maybe from the marketing side a little bit more, but understanding what is going on in sales. So I wanted him to come on the podcast today to talk about his theories, his passions, as it relates to top of funnel especially, but some of the newer things that are coming out and some of the newer terms that really resonate with us as we start working through figuring out how to be heard, how to be seen, how to get in front of people. He's really focused on that. So welcome to the podcast, Sean.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us more about the research firm and what got you interested in it and what are you guys working on these days?
Well, I promise to keep this short. We've always found ourselves probably, if you listen to podcasts enough, listening to 7-minute intros. So I promise I won't do that.
Okay.
So if you want to find out more, we're at CascadeInsights.com. I'm the CEO. The firm's co-owned by another guy named Scott Swigert. We're equal owners. Been running it since 2006. Really narrow front door to the firm. We just focus on working with technology companies, which we predominantly mean computer software by that. And we do market research and competitive work for them. And we've been doing it, for a while now. I got into it because I like research. I like helping companies solve problems. We get hired for one of two things, either pain or opportunity. Pain in the form of a competitor that's causing them some kind of grief, and opportunity because they're maybe launching a new product or a new initiative into a market segment. Boutique company of about 12 employees in Portland. We're always interested in talking to folks that want to move to Portland, which usually is pretty easy for us. It's an easy town to recruit from. And, I've been a business owner for 20 years, had a previous company before that I grew and sold to. And that's basically the bio.
Okay. Well, we talked offline a little bit about some topics that we thought might be of interest to my audience, which are mostly sales professionals who are responsible for business development, typically net new logos. And you hit on a term that I was like, all right, this is, we really want to know this. And there was what they don't do was one term that you mentioned. Marketing the invisible was another. And then you started talking about personas. So pick either one of those and go. Just tell us what you think we need to know. Top of funnel, building pipeline for net new sales.
Yeah, sure. Well, the interesting thing I think about marketing these days, and this is something I've talked a fair amount about on my show, B2B Revealed, and done it with a lot of marketing leaders and stuff too. People are living in the age of narrow. I don't know if I coined that phrase. So for those of you out there, if you found the post that already has it in it, you can tell me that I didn't. Just send me an email and say, no, you didn't coin it. You just hadn't come across it yet.
Okay.
But I don't think I've seen it yet. And everybody has to narrowcast. Nobody broadcasts anymore. And yet companies are still broadcasting. We'll do brand studies for tech companies, and they are completely undifferentiated.
Hmm.
They use the same colors. It's like they hired the same graphic artists.
Right.
They hired the same people that wrote messaging, which probably is true because they left from one company and went to go work at the other one. So they wrote the messaging the same. The ads are all very safe. And nobody says what they don't do. They just don't. They never find any boundary to their area of competency. And yet, there must be a boundary.
Yeah.
Because I've seen people kind of fight me back on this, and they say, well, no, I don't want to miss out on any opportunity. I'm like, okay, well, do you build rockets? Do you know what I mean? Like there's things you don't do, right? There's some limit to your firm's capabilities. And they're like, well, we might do that. Okay, yes. And when you do that, and you can prove it, and you have testimonials, and you have all kinds of things that you do to prove things, then say, we're going to move the fence post out a little farther, and now this is what we don't do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's just a hunger for it in the marketplace. Everybody is overpitched. They're pitched by seller emails that are on 17-step email chains to the point that you're like, oh, wow, that's the same email chain from Yesware I saw yesterday. Different company, though.
Different company, right.
But it's the same chain. They all read the same prospecting book, right?
Right.
And nobody seems to be willing to say, what's my boundary? As a side note, I think that's particularly important for services firms. And there's a reason I say that. The product firms, by definition, you're a little bounded by your product, but we also know that's gray, right? You know, we have a data center appliance that does everything. You know, and so, you know, our platform is always code for just buy it from us. It'll do anything you want, right? Which never really plays out, you know, but that's what platform sometimes is used for. And so, but services firms are even more fungible in a way, right? They, because it's consulting and it's using brains, you know, as opposed to like software directly, there's this tendency, I think, for consulting firm owners in particular, to say like, well, sure, we could do that. I just go hire some folks and grab some contractors and we'll get it done. And, I think, you know, when you're what I sometimes call marketing the invisible, which is a play off a book, a very direct play. So I want to pay homage to it. There's a fairly famous old book called Selling the Invisible. But when you're marketing the invisible, you're marketing professional services. I think it's incredibly important to differentiate on what you don't do. And just try it once is what I would tell people. You know, if you're like, well, he's out of his mind, they must lose all kinds of opportunity. Okay, fine. Take one call and burn it. Get on the call and start the call by saying what you don't do. And I guarantee you'll probably sell that person on whatever it is you do, because I've seen it over and over again. Another way I've said it sometimes is like you win more by saying no than yes. Because people just don't hear it. They're not used to it. And again, it's a smart no. It's not an obnoxious no. It's not an arrogant no. It's just a smart no. And if you know when to use it, I think you're in a really good place. And so that's to me all about the age of narrow. Like you have to let people know what lane you're in, at least for that call, that opportunity. And where I think that helps marketing is there's so much content out there. And I'll stop after this point. I want to, you know, chime in and ask whatever questions or direct me however you like. But one of the other things I kind of rant about sometimes is the content marketing intelligentsia, right? I go to these conferences and over again, they're like, you need better quality content. And I've always said that something said solemnly and slowly doesn't make it smart. Right? I mean, we've seen this a million times, right? You're in a meeting and a guy says, or a woman says, you know, we need to take a focus on accountability. And you're like, what's new about that? Like, we've been accountable since like the Middle Ages, right? I mean, I don't understand this. And so, quality doesn't do it anymore. It's not enough. It's simply not enough. So now you have to decide, how am I going to narrowcast that? Am I going to write the right ads that narrowcast to it for pay-per-click? Am I going to put it on the right properties that narrowcast? Am I going to even broadcast, you know, sometimes a phrase I'll use is broadcast on channel 800. You know, am I going to broadcast on channel 800 because I know it's going to exactly get to my buyers? And maybe I have another campaign on channel 801 for the other thing I offer. But I'm not going to try to do this thing where I broadcast everything on channel 8 and my brand and my logo and my funnel looks just like everybody else.
Right, right. I can totally relate to saying what you don't do. I just launched a class myself, and it's a 12-week instructor-led, i.e. me, class. And in the video for the classes that I've introduced, I said, basically, do not take this class unless you're ready to commit to a 12-week college-style course where I want you to finish it. You can't abandon me halfway through. If you think you're the abandoning type, don't even bother to register, because you're not going to get value. I'm not going to get value. So to have the courage to eliminate, which is probably most of my market, because we all know the abandonment rates of online courses are very high. But now I have a solid student body that's taking this class that I know will be successful because they'll do the work. So I could totally relate to the saying no thing.
And I would take that one step further. I think the thing is also, what does the class not do? What is this class not for, right?
Right?
Who should not read this book? Who should not listen to this podcast, right?
Yeah.
And I think, but you're right. Like saying no. And a funny vignette on training. You're very smart to do that, because like, early in my career, one of the things I got started. Full disclosure, I'm 47, so I've been in tech for a while. I was doing technical training. So I was teaching networking and software and database and programming. And these were 5-day courses when that was kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And I remember every Monday I'd do something religiously. So how many of you have read the outline before you came here? Before you flew to Denver from all around the world, how many of you read the outline?
Right.
Consistently, the early market researcher in me, it was like 5% of the room.
Right.
And part of me as an entrepreneur is like, I'm not flying anywhere for 5 days if I don't know what I'm going to get out of it. Like, I don't know who does that, right? I mean, I have things to do. I just sit with my kids and like go take them fishing instead, right? Something.
Right.
And, and I'm amazed at how many people kind of walk into a room, and I'm not trying to knock listeners or anything, but, you know, ask yourself, how many times did you go somewhere just kind of because you were following everybody, right? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or it's like, this just seemed like a good idea. And it sets up such a huge problem for both sides, because by Monday afternoon, you feel like you shouldn't be there. The instructor feels like they can't answer your questions because you shouldn't have been there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just that degree of clarity that I think we have to kind of just shove out there. And it's on the brands and the companies to do it, because right. they're the ones sending the messaging.
And, you know, they're sending the messaging, but in business development, we're parroting the messaging because we're reaching out
right.
and we are basically the billboard, the human billboard for the company. So the words, the language, the usage, the use cases, everything is driven by what we're told to say to gain interest.
But let me stop you there. One of the other things that I think should... there's a talk I give sometimes called Marketing the Invisible, and which is kind of why I brought that thing up before. But like, I think one of the things I say in it is that your messaging should come from sales.
Yes.
And how many times have we seen it where like if you went in your average enterprise company, right, they're going to sit and they're going to have a message meeting. And who's going to be in the room? And I know this is true because we do market research on messaging. And we will come into the meet stakeholders, and I will meet the stakeholders, and we love our stakeholders. Don't anybody stop working with us about what I'm going to say next. But I will go in and meet the stakeholders, and this will be some fairly big, you know, technology product. And I'll go around the room, and 75% of them will be from marketing. There'll be somebody there from market research. There'll be somebody there from product development. There'll be nobody there from sales.
Right.
Nobody there from sales. And I'm like, sales is the ultimate qualitative market research source you could find.
Mm-hmm.
We did a blog post of this on our website called Sales Needs a Say in Strategy. And all we said in it was, we get sales has their biases. You know, they're always going to complain about price and they're always going to complain about certain things. I mean, we get that, right? And sales never has good enough leads. I don't care what they are, right? But, mm-hmm. but at the end of the day, sales is having messaging conversations.
Right.
That's what they're doing. And if you, and I'm talking about B2B more than B2C, like in B2C, I that's not a space I play in really, but like I could see why you want to push messaging down into the call center a little bit differently. But I think there's even a point of doing this there where you kind of take it back and you say, who has the best conversations? What are they saying? What are the phrases? What is the language they're using? What's the tone? What, and then say, does our messaging look anything like that? Like, because I think what happens a lot of times is the messaging is vanilla, generic, or off target, and sales has to fix it live. It's like giving an actor a script that's busted and broken, and they have to go up on stage and just kind of ad lib until it's right. And I think that's the wrong way to fly. And I do understand the risk when some marketers probably listen to this saying, ask sales. That seems crazy, you know? And I'm like, but ask yourself. Who's actually having the conversation that changes minds?
Mm-hmm.
Probably sales.
Yeah. We did a test recently in one of my classes where we had, I run into this situation all the time, so I am feeling the pain that you're talking about. We had marketing create our cadence, our rhythm, our, you know, sort of secret sauce of how we talk to clients. And they put it into a touch sequence. So we took a couple of the marketing generated emails. I had my students pretend they were talking to the prospect belly to belly, record in their phone the sales conversation, get it transcribed, and then we assembled a test email to compete against the marketing email. Overwhelmingly, the response rates and the conversion rate of the sales generated talk track, you know, kind of buckled together versus the marketing speak won. And we had tremendous response rates to compared to what marketing did. We used their baseline. We used the sentiment. We used the pain points and the way the argument was positioned by marketing, but we transcribed it into sales speak, and it resonated a lot more with our target audience.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, and one caution that I know that I'm sure marketers are thinking too, like, I've never seen a salesperson who avoids a run-on sentence, right? So like, just jokingly, right? You know what I mean? So, right. So sure, you know, one of my favorite movies is A River Runs Through It, and my marketing manager's nickname is Half as Long, and if anybody's ever seen that scene in the movie where like, he tells him to rewrite it and tells him to keep making it shorter and shorter, and then in the end he says, throw it away. Right.
Right.
And it's really comical because she's about 5 feet tall. So she finds it doubly funny, like that this is her nickname. Like I didn't necessarily give it to her. I told her about the scene and she was like, I love that because I like sentences that are half as long. I really love them, you know. And so, you know, I think it's this relationship that needs to be there.
Right.
And everybody's talked about that. I just haven't really seen anybody brave enough usually to say sales needs to kind of drive a lot of the messaging, and then marketing's more in the assistant role.
When we go up market, that I just retained a new client, for example, where marketing came in on the initial call, very feathers ruffled. You can feel it, hear it, see it in the voice, and that they're like, why are you here? Why are you doing this? Why are you setting up these sequences? This is our job. This is what we do. So it starts off a little rocky, but then as we start working together, and business development is the perfect area for the blend and the collaboration between marketing and sales, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's why I said, like, if you're selling stuff out of a call center and it's B2C, I mean, I understand, you know, if you put a 19-year-old on the phone and they're selling, heaven forbid, although I know this happens, you put a 19-year-old on the phone and they're selling complex cybersecurity solutions as an SDR, right? Okay, please give them a script, right? I understand that. But when it's, you know, the belly to belly B2B selling, like you joke,
right.
You know what I mean? It's different then. And I know we were going to talk a little bit about this, so it was probably a good point to segue, I guess, or bring me back if you don't want to go here. But that whole point about, websites kind of targeting the wrong persona, it has kind of a similar play, I think.
That's a big one for me, because a lot of times, and this is sales' fault, so sales sitting out there, this is your fault, because we're taking the marketing personas as ours. And the call to action on a marketing persona is typically to gain interest. The call to action on a business development is to get the first meeting. So just by definition, we have two different persona definitions. One is slanted more towards sales. So we can use marketing's persona and we love what they have done, but we need to add on to that to create the selling canvas of what we're trying to do, which is to get that first meeting, get our foot in the door, start building those relationships.
Right, exactly. And I think one of the places where this gets misaligned is that we'll get brought in to do research. And one of the normal things people will say to us is like, well, or we ask them, I guess, is we say like, who are the right people for the study? And, you know, a lot of times people will say like C-levels or VP levels or whatever. And we always probe that, because one of the things we find is not only is it maybe wrong because it's not where they spend the bulk of their sales time, which is how I'll pivot for them sometime. I'll be like, how much of your sales cycle is spent in the C-levels office?
Right.
And like, what do you mean? No, I'm like, really? Like, how much of the cycle is spent there? Mm-hmm. And they're like, 5% toward the end. Okay, so do we have a front funnel problem we're trying to adjust with this research, or back funnel problem, right? You know what I mean? Because it's two different things. And the same thing with the websites. If you go through your average tech company websites, because that's the space we hang out in, if you go through and look at them, they'll have C-level language almost all the way through them.
Right.
Do C-levels go to Google and try to find vendors to solve, I don't know, marketing automation, cybersecurity, document management? I don't think
AI.
AI? No. The data, you know, data scientists goes. I mean, so there, the idea that your website is kind of aligned with these like senior strategic perspectives, I think it's kind of a fail, right? Because, it should be aligned with the people who are going to come visit it. And like you were alluding to earlier, you know, there's multiple people in this sale. CEB right. said it and everybody else has said it. And it's funny, no matter how many times people say that, like 5.4 people, 6.8 people, 3.2 people, whatever statistic you want that's greater than one,
right.
People act like it's one.
Mm-hmm.
They do it over and over again, right? They title lock on this one persona. And I don't know if it's an expediency thing. I don't know if it's just a human nature thing. I don't know what it is. But they have a really hard time kind of blending it in a meaningful way and giving like on-ramps to each type of person. There are companies that do it well. I mean, surprisingly, Microsoft's actually one of them. I mean, which might shock anybody listening because usually they're the punching bag for certain things. But they, if you look at some of the portions of their website that target individual types of buyers and technical folks, I'm not talking about the mm-hmm. consumer side of their business. They sometimes do a pretty good job of that. So anyway, I think that's another place where there's a lot of room for improvement. And that's also a relationship between sales and marketing, because they can talk a little more about like, well, where do we spend the bulk of our time in a sales cycle? What's the initial contact like, and who is that? And all of that stuff really matters.
I think there's a little bit of a mystique around, hey, if I start too low from the sales perspective, then I'm going to get stuck in the lower echelons. But if I start high and get referred down, then the cultural biases and behavioral biases will help me get in the door of the right people eventually. But if I start high and work low, I'm going to have better success than starting low and working high. And that's, I think, partly sales issue, where they don't want to get stuck at a certain level and not be able to go up. You hear that all the time. So just sell to the C-suite. They'll refer you down to the right person. And then eventually you can work with the right people to get further into the cycle.
Yeah,
so all the marketing for us starts higher level to get, hey, go take a look at these people. Go look at these guys. They sent me an email. I like what they're saying. That's, I think, why we do that as well. We start higher to lower. It's easier to get referred down.
Right. But if you went into the database and said, like, for all those contact form fills, how many of them said CIO at the bottom?
Very few.
I think they'd be very few would say CIO, right? And so, and I think you get higher up. That's where marketing can help, like mm-hmm. in the sense of with more of maybe not the front door to the site, but things that actually can be directed to, you know, so that like you can get some mind share with those upper level folks. Because if somebody underneath them forwards them something, that's fine. But that's different than the front door to the site that's going to be discovered initially by that kind of lower level person, which is all tied to the idea that a lot of the sales funnel has become digital. Right.
Yeah.
And so you know, if that wasn't true and it was simply a matter of where do I choose to enter the atmosphere on this company's home planet? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it was old school selling and we were just dialing for dollars. Sure.
Right.
Right. Start high. I mean, I'm going to enter the atmosphere and land there. That's where I want to go. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's organic and I have to wait for them to move a little bit, well, then I've just got to deal with realities. The CIO is not web searching.
No. Hence the reason why, you know, there are multiple ways that we get into an account. It's not just digital. There's analog versions. There's direct mail even has a comeback for some of the work that we do to bring awareness around our offer, our service, why we matter, why they should change, why now. So I think having an arsenal of, or what my friend calls, you know, the toolkit of getting in the door of various things depending on the persona, but you can't narrow the personas to the point where you're just talking to one person type. You've got to branch out and get multiple opinions, multiple conversations going, so that finally someone's going to invite you in because you're persistent. It's persistence of a good message, I think, that gets you in the door more often than targeting the right person, so to speak, or going to the CEO or the CFO. You're going to be banging your head against the wall half the time trying to get in.
Yeah, well, persistence definitely matters. I mean, that's for sure. I mean, I think that's been true in sales for a long time. I mean, appropriately pursued accounts are going to get one. I mean, all the stats show it, right? You look at the number of responses to email sequences. There's this huge bump when you get to four or five or six, which is why we all get seven or eight of them, right? And so, yeah. I mean, and that's been true for a very long time.
We all get 7 or 8, but some of them are not worthy of responding. I mean, I get, like you said before, it's so resonated with me. I think I've seen the same yes-wear template 50 times in 1 week in my inbox. I mean, let's get a little bit more creative, people, about how we address our target market. I mean, it's just, if I hear this one more time about just checking in to see, or did you get my previous email? Did you see my previous thread? It's like, no, I did not.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Well, there's definitely, I actually interviewed somebody for my show a way back, and we had a really good conversation, but I'm not trying to throw him under the bus, but we had a conversation about something, and I asked him kind of a little to the side. I said, so do you think, like, the fact that you own one of these sales automation platforms that, you know, helps people generate lots of emails is, and I said it a little differently than this, but to summarize it for the show, like, is contributing a lot of evil to the world? You know, do you really think that's, like, you know, I mean, is that possible? You know, I wasn't quite that pointed, right? But I said, you know,
evil empire.
right. All of this email that nobody wants, right? And he said, no, absolutely not. If they don't want it, they can just delete it. And I'm kind of like, okay, well,
that's not the point.
Yes. It's not the point, you know, and so, and he said a lot of other great things, but then that one area I felt like it was a misfire. It was like, there's a lot of bad that's being done with those tools. And I don't think it's entirely going away. Although I will say GDPR has put a nice little chilling effect on some of that kind of behavior.
Most definitely. But I don't know if you've been looking at that. The delivery rates, the bounce rates are off the charts now. Things are not going through.
Well, right. And I was jokingly telling our staff because we ended up getting a lot of work in the last few weeks, even just from GDPR rolling out, because in our world, a certain percentage of the work is done with, let's say, the customer's list. We will do our own recruiting for research, certainly, and we do that a lot. But so their own list, though, they're not sure how clean they are. These are very large companies, and who knows if somebody loaded something into it a long time ago, and there's issues with, like, GDPR isn't about the domain the person's from. It's where the citizen they are of, you know, the country they're of. And so they could be in a different locale at the moment. And so it's really, really fascinating. So we've been joking about the fact that I'm sure all of next year's marketing sessions at conferences are going to be things like how GDPR killed our email list, how we survived with our email letter with, you know, GDPR, how, you know, I mean, because, it's just not, it's not going to be the same world. And there's a lot of other stuff that tied with that too. You know, the fishbowl at the trade show. If you're following the letter of that law, and we all know that we're 20 court cases away from maybe really understanding what that law does, you know, because there's a lot of edge cases that have to be played out. But it's just a sign that some of that kind of just slam the universe with a bunch of emails kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Is just going away. And so then we're going to have to figure out what we're going to do after that.
I mean, I'm double opted in on my email list, and I sent out an email to my list prior to GDPR saying, hey, we're starting from scratch. So this is my last email to you. And if you want to come join my list again, we're going to have to go through everything all over again with the notices for GDPR. So I immediately went from X to zero. Overnight.
Well, that's interesting, because that's actually exactly what I said a few weeks back. I said there's a lot of small companies that will just make the decision to basically delete their list, not because they were doing anything wrong. It's just they don't have the ability to go through a full compliance regime, and it's easier to just say to the list, "Will you come back?" And one of the funniest things I saw on that, I don't know if you saw it, but there's a Quartz article that came out right around the day GDPR launched. And it was the reporters had collected all the subject lines they were receiving, and they categorized them by emotion. So it was like angry, dismissive, sad, depressed. You know what I mean? Like, we don't want to lose you from our list. You know what I mean? It was just really funny.
Or funny. Because it was like, here we are. We're getting rid of you now. I mean, list, I got complaints to send out that last email. That's the first time I've ever gotten complaints when I sent out that GDPR email.
Complaints in what way?
When they clicked the complaint button, I don't know. It's just when it showed up on my automation system, it said a percent complaints. of the email itself. And I've never gotten that red little flag on any of my email that I've sent out over the years. It's the first time.
Well, what's interesting about email chains, you know, we went through a period of experimentation with, you know, kind of a little more broad-based email campaigns, you know, mm-hmm. a few years back. And we actually shut it all down and invested more in kind of top of the funnel marketing, you know, to kind of like drive engagement. And one of the reasons I shut it down finally was I realized when somebody can send you an email where they're basically not even reading the email, mm-hmm. but you can just tell, and they're your right kind of buyer, and all they do is say, take me off your list. I don't know how you got my name. I have nothing to do with you. And this was the right persona with the right message that in a sales conversation, that exact same language would resonate. Mm-hmm. It just tells me I'm just annoying them. They've just decided that an email inbound from a vendor they don't know just gets vaporized.
Yes.
And worse yet, I've probably left a stain with them that if they ever remember who we are, and I have a sales conversation later, mm-hmm. we've got an issue. So,
exactly.
So yeah, I, and that doesn't mean all of those email sequences need to go to content heaven, right? They don't need to all die. I just think that, or content hell, I guess in this case, but see, I think, only good stuff should go to content heaven. Right. But I think, I think it's a matter of time before that stuff has to just evolve. Because honestly, a lot of these automation platforms have created the problem because there's some young startup with three people and they go do it. Now listeners might be thinking like, well, what's the solution? And I would say it's back to the age of Nero. And, you know, you have to decide, you know, what are your channels 800, 801, 802, 803 that you're going to broadcast on? And you're just going to send messaging that is just really tailored to them. And there's no excuse in digital. You can make really targeted stuff like that. So that's really the thing. And the only reason people aren't doing it is because broadcast is technically easier than narrowcasting.
At least that's what I think. No, I mean, it's in the mindset right now. It's the rhythmic mindset of that's what you do, is that you just throw it out to the wind and hope for the best, and you're okay with a response rate that's suboptimal. Because that means, you know, if you get 3 out of 100, that's better than nothing. So I think a lot of it, but I see the narrowing happening. I mean, I know for even me, for my work, when predictable revenue came out, we talked a lot about transactional type of emails, and now it's hyper personalized, and it's looking at signals that are coming in, leveraging some of the tools that can see when people are talking about you. That's a nice way to kind of segue into, hey, I saw you were talking about me in this article. I'd like to introduce myself. Thanks for saying that, or whatever it is. It gives you a reason to have a conversation. So I see more of that. And we're back to our 20 to 30 accounts a day, like we always were, where we work the 20 accounts a day and we find something unique and different to discuss with our 20 accounts and the people within those accounts. And we keep hammering away until pleasantly, persistently, until we get to a point where we decide, yeah, maybe we should put them in incubation and bring somebody else in to replace that account.
Yeah. And it's basically a more humane way of selling and marketing, and it's what people want. And I think you're right about the 20 to 30 accounts, you know, so.
Or my friend Anthony says 40 to 60. I personally cannot do 40 to 60 a day. I don't know how he does it, but he's a machine. But I do 20 to 30, and that seems to work just fine. That's my number, and I can get those done and still have a life at the end of the day. So.
Yeah, and I think it's really a number of contacts at the end of the day, right? Because it obviously depends on if, you know, depending on where you're at in the sales world, are you kind of managing a couple like mega accounts, or are you managing individual accounts? But you're right. You have to know kind of your limit in the number of kind of touch points you can manage if they're related to complex sales processes without turning yourself into some transactional robot or having too few of those relationships too. But
the key for us is the waterfall. We have to, you know, I can't tell you how many people don't have a waterfall. How many opportunities do we need to have for a month to generate the revenue we're looking for to get the commission structure or the life that we want? And you work it backwards from that, and that's your number. And I can't tell you how many times I've had to put students through What is your number? What does that mean in terms of conversations or discovery calls and fit calls? And that'll back up all the way up the funnel to how many accounts you need to be looking at on a daily basis and how many conversations you need to be having on a daily basis to make that number. People don't do that.
No, they don't. And the other thing that I think is interesting on that point is that we have a little tool that we use internally for my team of seller doers, because we're a consulting firm. So we don't, you know, outside of, you know, I guess my role is kind of leading sales and marketing and business ops. We don't have quite a dedicated seller, and I'm not a full-time seller either. You know, that's typical of consulting firms. The principals will sell some, and different levels of people in the company will do seller doer activities. But related to what you're getting at about kind of knowing how your activity leads to an end result, we have a little bit of a leaderboard that I include kind of all of the sales activities that somebody should do in a month. And we kind of keep track of it in a fun leaderboard kind of way. Because the other thing I think that happens is you just forget to do the hygiene, right? You fall into the habit of taking, you know, 7 phone calls with your favorite sales friends that you call, and you forget to go out there and just prospect on LinkedIn and see who changed jobs and see what's going on. And then you forgot to freshen up, you know, your Twitter account or do whatever, you know, whatever those 20 or 30 things that you need to do a month to keep going. And some of them you do, I'll give my business partner credit for this phrase, but, he said, we're either busy or busy trying to be busy. So, you know, and which is, I think really good business owners, that's kind of where they're at, like just mentally, right? You know, there's no, there's no other switch than those two things. And, you need to have a framework for the second part of that, right? That's more than just a couple set of actions, but anyway.
Yeah. And you need to habit stack. That was a term my doctor gave to me because I was trying to do a handstand when I turned 60. That was my goal, to do a handstand. And so he said, well, habit stack, Mary Lou. I'm like, what the heck are you talking about? Because I couldn't even do a push-up at the time. So when I got my coffee, I would do one push-up. And now I'm up to 20 push-ups while I'm waiting for my coffee. So you add on to these good habits, and eventually, rather than grit and discipline, it becomes habit. And that's what we need in our role, to continually generate the revenue and the opportunities that we're looking for. So it's a process, but we can get there, but we can't do this sort of shiny object thing and go to the next thing without finishing the task we had at hand. It's tough to teach that. Very tough.
Yeah, I love that, though. I'm going to steal that habit stack. I think the staff's going to hear that from me the minute this podcast interview is over. So I think I'll send out an email.
Very good. Speaking of which, we've gone way over our time, but that's okay. Sean, how do people get a hold of you to learn more about you, your firm, and what you do? What's the best way that we can connect with you?
Well, a few things. If you want to hear my voice more, if you haven't heard enough of it already, you can go to check out our show. It's called B2B Revealed. It's on all the major podcast players. We interview a lot of B2B thought leaders, book authors, folks focused on marketing and sales issues. We also hit some hot button issues sometimes, like we cover business neutrality. I just recently did an interview on CEO activism that'll go live in a few weeks.
Wonderful.
That was really interesting. And and then in terms of the company, it's cascadeinsights.com. And there you'll find a bunch of stuff about us in terms of like who we work with and what we do and what we don't do. And so you'll get some sense about that too. And finally, anybody can reach out to me directly if they want. My email is just Sean, S-E-A-N at cascadeinsights.com. And thanks for having me.
I'll be sure to put all this on your page. So if you guys are driving right now and trying to find a piece of paper, don't worry. It'll be on his page with his beautiful picture out of Portland, Oregon, where we stood in line for Voodoo Donuts one time for almost an hour just to get a donut.
with many people, if you go through PDX, you're usually used to seeing, like, even if you're a native, you know, pretty much any flight out of PDX, there's somebody holding a pink box of Voodoo Donuts almost guaranteed, like on their flight. So yeah, no, that's definitely a good place. On a later show, we'll do it again. I'll tell you all the places to go in Oregon. So, you know, we'll cover that.
Oh, perfect.
Too.
Love that. My little girl's looking at Vancouver, Washington, because she loves that area up there. She's in college right now. We have a ways to go, but she definitely has her eyes set on that area as a place to potentially open up a trampoline gym, of all things.
No, that would work out here. This is definitely alternative sports land in a good way. Like, I was a Midwest kid that, I'll make this fast, but like, I was a Midwest kid, grew up in Chicago, moved out here 25 years ago, so I can totally fake native here. I joke that I've done everything but shoot something, meaning like I haven't hunted, right? And so, because I love the outdoors here, I've got a boat and a trailer and we fish and camp and hike and everything. But
it's wonderful.
But I grew up in the era of, you know, the city I grew up in, we all talked baseball, football. Out here, everybody has an alternative sport, trampoline gym, skiing, kickball. There's kickball leagues here. My business partner's been in a few of those. So that's kind of a fun thing. I mean, so it's a great place to do those kinds of things and a bunch of other stuff.
Wonderful. Well, Sean, thank you so much for your time, and we enjoyed the conversation. We'll be in touch, and I will put all the notes on your page so people can get a hold of you to find out more. Thanks again.